Hello and welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmstead, the holographic physician. And my special guest tonight is Rick Miller, physicist and also farmer and metaphysician. And if you've listened to him before on this show talking about the holographic universe and the non-local mind, then you know you're in for a treat. So welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, Val. It's nice to be with you again. What would you like to talk about tonight?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because you have so many things that we could talk about. But I was thinking that, you know, it's important for people to understand how important it is to start growing their own foods and things. And so
the apocalypse. Oh, yeah. Well, 2012. There's always an important aspect to having a relationship with the soil, putting your hands in the garden, having a victory garden, or in some way producing something that you didn't buy, something that you created yourself with the earth. And as the gas prices are going to go up, you're going to watch the quality of food deteriorate in the various grocery stores, you're going to watch the prices go up, and you're going to become more aware of how important it is to eat whole, real foods. It's essential now.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with that. And, you know, as we've been visiting, we've been talking about, you know, the fact that food prices have already doubled.
That's
and
right.
And gas prices have doubled.
It's just getting food to market. It's going to, and the cost of manufacturing foods. I don't know if you're going to see an extreme change this month, but I know for a fact that within the next 2 months, things are going to be so extreme that everybody will remember what I said. This is going to happen now because of fuel prices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as Madeline and I have been traveling on the West Coast here, we have seen the gas jump from, like, we were complaining at $3.25 a gallon in Sedona. And as we came further west and further north, it jumped up and up and up until we were at, like, $3.90 a gallon.
Yeah. And that was the way it was in Brookings today, yeah.
Yeah, and the problem is that people don't see the far-reaching effects of that yet. You know, first they're just looking at it and saying, oh, gas is too expensive and we can't go take a vacation. But right now, I mean, you know, as we've been talking about the farming situation and how much stuff is brought in, not only by trucks from here in the U.S. or Canada or Mexico, but also all the stuff that's brought over in ships, and they take huge amounts of fuel.
That's right.
You know, I think that a lot of our international produce may become, you know, like gold.
Well, it's going to be different than that. There's actually there's a book called In Defense of Real Food, and actually people have options even right now in the kinds of foods that they can choose. The key word is unprocessed. If you can stay away from unprocessed foods, probably your diet is going in the right direction.
You mean processed foods?
Yeah, not eating processed foods, potato
right.
chips, mm-hmm. things that have been where they've had to somehow add additives to mm-hmm. preserve it, to do this to it, to do that to it. I think that it's more important to learn how to graze and not eat meals. You know, it's interesting where the mythology came from on food and the three meals a day. It was basically God telling the ox god to tell man he needed to eat once every third day. And
mm-hmm.
the ox god got it wrong and said he needed to eat three times a day, which is literally almost nine times more food than man really needs to eat.
Wow.
Some of the Russian studies showed that grazing, rather than eating meals like lunches and dinners and suppers, that it was important to just eat different food groups at different times of the day as a type of grazing thing, not as a formal meal, and that if you did that, you ended up eating less, eating more efficiently, and healthier.
Well, and that makes sense, too, because one of the first things that they tell you, you know, when you're looking to lose weight is that if you keep feeding your body when it says it's really hungry, you know, and you have to recognize the difference between hunger pangs and, you know, need for a little bit of fuel versus habits and, you know, emotional needs. But if you can ferret those, the differences between those two things out, and then eat, you know, like a handful of grapes, and then maybe, you know, an hour and a half later you might eat an apple, and an hour and a half later you might have a couple pieces of beef, or, you know, or a couple pieces of bread or whatever. But, you know, it, yeah, that constant grazing diet actually fuels your body more efficiently.
It's and you're eating different food groups, which means you're metabolizing the foods differently as well.
Yeah. Yeah, because the problem is when we dump everything in our stomach at once, then we require all these different enzymes to digest it. And most of those enzymes are going to cancel each other out. And so this
That's
is one of the things that I teach people, you know, when I have them in as patients. It's like, you know, quit eating all these different food groups together, because you're not going to get, you know, clear enzyme action on them. You're going to have indigestion. You're going to have constipation. And all these things, you know, your food just gets pooped out, basically. You know, you don't get enough nutrients from it. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, the other thing, too, you and I were talking about, you know, how important it is to eat locally, you know, to get our fruits and our vegetables.
Oh, that's Gurdjieff, yeah. Gurdjieff once used to say that you should eat your environment, that you would find, you know, people in the way far north, like when I was working with the Koryak, these are Eskimos, they needed a much heavier fat diet and ate blubber and actually ate that as part of their requirements for being able to survive in that kind of an environment. Of course, if we ate that kind of food down here in the lower 48, it would not be very healthy for us. In fact, it could prove to be disastrous. But the whole nature of macrobiotics and the idea of eating products that are literally grown in from your environment seem to have climatized for light and soil conditions, things of that nature, help one develop what we call adaptogens in the body. You know, like eating the local honey would give you the pollen for antibodies, you know, for allergies, whereas eating honey from Spain or Mexico is, it doesn't have the same kind of presentation to the physical body in terms of eating your local foods. And then, of course, herbs, you'll always find analogs wherever. For example, in Oregon, here we live, Oregon grapefruit is a chemical analog to golden seal. In other words, I don't have to go to Tennessee to get my golden seal. I could eat Oregon grapefruit, which also has hydrastine and barbarian chemistries in it, from the local source. And in fact, it's different in its measures because our environment is slightly different than, let's say, Tennessee. And that's one of the reasons why the chemistries vary like they do. It's an interesting form of metaphysics in terms of, you know, approaching what you should eat and how you should eat. Of course, vegetarians wouldn't want to eat fish, but it's now discovered that people living on the coast have much less cancer when they eat these salmon and halibut because of the omega-3 oils. It's part of the diet of the West Coast, which might not be as appropriate, let's say, for the Midwest or something like that.
Yeah, that makes perfectly good sense, too. You know, and again, I'm thinking about the enzyme systems.
Right.
Because, you know, what they found out recently is there are so many problems with people's enzyme systems in the liver, and there's so many of them, you know, pages and pages and pages of listed enzyme systems. And I remember talking to one of the guys that does environmental health in naturopathic medicine. And I said, well, oh my gosh, what are we supposed to do? How do we know somebody has enzyme deficiencies? He said, we don't. It's a crapshoot.
Well,
you know, part of it is...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. But Val, you can also talk about having ATP present. If you have ATP present, your adenosine triphosphate, that's like the chemical handshake that starts and ends all enzymic processes, which means the body is a pretty sophisticated laboratory. It can actually order up a lot of different kinds of enzymes. And while you might have loose stool or loose bowel for a couple of days trying to build up enzymes, let's say after not having eaten meat, and then all of a sudden you started eating meat and you had bowel problems. It takes only a couple of days for the body, but what you need in the body even more is the handshake, the ATP. For me, I think that's where cold fusion occurs in the body. I think it's adenosine triphosphate. I think that it's shaped like a little vortex. It looks mm-hmm. like a little plasma generator and is required as the handshake to start and end all enzymic processes. And it turns out there are foods that you can eat that will increase your ATP levels, which is what I would call juice. You know, the energy that someone seems to have to be able to, boy, he's got a lot of energy, you know, that kind of place. That's, mm-hmm. I think, starts with ATP.
Interesting. Now, what kind of foods would somebody eat for that?
Well, the pharmaceutical mushrooms, one of the things I'm representing is my swan song as I'm leaving. I'm 64, I took early retirement, and I'm moving away from the pharmaceutical trade now. And I am so fortunate to have discovered what we call pharmaceutical mushrooms. I gave you a book, Halperin's book, to read on it. Mm-hmm. It's your Garrucus blasii, your maitake, your shiitake, your all these different reishi mushroom, inoculus, cordyceps. There's about 72 known different forms of pharmaceutical mushrooms now that have large volumes of what we call polysaccharides and beta-glucans. Mm-hmm. And the polysaccharides are basically huge, long sugar complexes full of oxygen. In fact, a polysaccharide might have as many as 100 oxygen bullets. It's that big a sugar. And when it breaks down, it releases oxygen on a cellular level, which means that cancers, that's why they're called pharmaceutical mushrooms, because they're used for cancer treatment, but that's just a byproduct. Really, what the polysaccharides are doing is creating adenosine triphosphate in the body. It's like the little spark plugs that mm-hmm. start the energy engines moving. And when you have more oxygen on a cellular level, now the body's able to do things it couldn't do in the kinds of foods that we're normally eating, the lung capacity and the way things are. That's what a polysaccharide is. The other chemistry in these mushrooms are called beta-glucans, which basically are also sugar molecules similar to the polysaccharides, except that they look a lot like bacteria. They're not bacteria, but they look like it. And so what happens next is your NK killer cells are released, thinking you've got a bacterial infection in your body, and these killer cells are released, which basically is fine-tuning your immune system. And if you mix new technology like transfer factor from women's colostrum or something of that nature, now you have a possibility of a food that acts like a broad-spectrum antibiotic substitute. And that combination, like cordyceps hybrid with transfer factor, is now being used in feedlots all through the world, where, you know, just the cordyceps itself is being used to treat HIV and AIDS in Africa. When you add transfer factor to it, now what's happening is that you've got a food that acts like an antibiotic substitute. They're currently using that in growth ponds for salmon up in Alaska. And because when they were growing salmon, like they do the Atlantic salmon, we were finding that the fish were rampant with disease. I mean, the genetics and all the rest of it, the fish got sick, and so they had to start dumping antibiotics into their food, which gets into the food chain and is not really good for any of us. But there's a couple of studies that took place up in BC. They actually used transfer factor and cordyceps hybrid. And what happened next was the fish started producing more actual protein on the fish itself. They were healthier. You had a less die-kill ratio, and you had no disease. And that's a food. That means by FDA. FDA classifies these as foods, which means they're not drugs, and all the ingredients in it when you break down the chemistry are what they call GRAS, or generally recognized as safe. There's no toxicity. The only thing that might happen is you're splitting the body too much protein too quickly, and then you have the loose bowel problem that you might have.
Mm. But that's amazing.
New discoveries.
And, you know, that I think that's a good thing for people to know about, because people for a long time have shied away from farm-fed fish, you know, for that reason.
They should, because most of the Atlantic salmon and other kinds of catfish, whatever that they're farming on the East Coast, out of growth ponds, most of that, when you have growth ponds where you're not doing, from the environment, farming from the environment, the fish tend to have genetic defects. They tend to have certain kinds of diseases that they don't become immune to, and so they're susceptible to it in large breeding ponds. And so what they have to do next is dump antibiotics in to keep the fish healthy. And none of that's any good for us. They do that. That's why they make a distinction between Arkansas fryers, chicken fryers, you know, that you might get at Walmart, and something that you'd buy as an Oregon fryer out of, you know, Market of Choice or something of that nature that does certified organic and so on. This is all part of buying real foods, ones that don't have additives, chemicals, pesticides, or even antibiotics added to the food to make it, you know, worthy of market. I think what we're going to find is it's going to get worse, very bad, and it'll become real apparent real quick to almost everybody why they want to eat real foods. It's not even going to be a no-brainer real quick.
Yeah, and I've seen that it already is happening, but I think that the general public doesn't notice it. I notice it because I'm a physician and I deal with these kinds of issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, I can pretty much tell when somebody walks in and plunks down in front of me and, you know, starts telling me the story. I can tell what kind of food that they're eating, and I can tell,
right,
you know, how quickly they can get well if they would just stop doing that and go to the right food. Now, my concern about
some people
about
don't want to get well.
Well,
actually,
sickness
has purpose.
Yeah.
There's actual reasons why we get sick that are good, really. Because, you know, sickness is a way that your body often tries to tell you that there's something wrong in the way you're living, or something you're doing wrong. It's like your subconscious trying to get your attention to your consciousness. And once you've got the message, there's no need to be sick anymore. And so you're not sick anymore. That's how it really works. That's why I've always recommended things like journaling, where you keep a diary and you have a magical memory, you know, where you can see how you felt at a given time, not try to recollect it, because foods and things like that, they need to be documented, how you feel about when you ate these kinds of foods, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, and I've used that a lot of times with my patients. I have them write down a food journal, and I always ask them, you know, are you peeing, pooping, sweating, and happy, seriously, and I want to know what it looks like. And the whole reason is because you can tell a lot of health of the body that way.
Oh,
and
that's correct.
I always ask them, you know, what is your energy level, and how do you feel mentally, emotionally? And I want all those components in there because it tells me if they're digesting and how well they're digesting. It tells me if the emunctories are open, and those are all the organs of elimination, listeners. But it tells me if there's something there that's a pattern. And, you know, my classic example is this lady that was a juvenile diabetic for 36 years, and she'd had these horrendous headaches. And I said, you know, keep a food journal, and I want to know X, Y, and Z. And she said, oh, I don't think I need to do that because, you know, my diet's really rock solid, and, you know, I've been doing this all my life, and blah, blah, blah. I said, humor me. You know, just give me the journal. When I saw the journal, I was flipping through it, and every time she ate this one particular food, she got bloating, and an hour later she had a headache. And when
isn't
she ate this other food, she got a migraine very quickly. And
but she didn't remember those things because that's the habit thing we think of, you know, where we don't pay attention.
Exactly.
Right.
So she thought that on the surface she was eating completely correctly. And I said, well, look at this. You're eating these particular foods, and you're eating them because you feel a little bit depressed or you're a little stressed out. So I said, so look at the whole pattern, you know, because here you are, you're stressed out, you're upset about something, you go eat your favorite comfort food, which happens to be something that you're allergic to, and so it's giving you migraine headaches.
You know, that's the reason why you do diaries, because they keep you honest in that regard. They can show trends over a period of a couple of months where you make these entries, and all of a sudden you start to see the dots being connected.
Mm-hmm.
What about blood types?
I've
always thought that blood types were important also. I've recognized, for example, in myself, being O negative, that I need more protein than beans and rice. I somehow can't just survive on beans and rice, even though they have all the amino acids needed, you know, essentials.
Oh, yeah, and I'm the same way. I'm a type O also, and you know, I do blood type diets with people. And, in fact, you know, I'm master's level certified and all that stuff with blood diets. I've used it extensively in my practice. And what I've noticed is that it does run true. And in even within each blood type, there's subtypes, you know, and there's other groups,
sure,
you know, genetic differences. But
well, and maybe
I've noticed too,
environmental, geographical.
Oh yeah, very very much so, and it's the time
yeah.
of the year. And
right.
like I tried to go back to being vegan. I've done that before. I did it for 4 years, and I was a rabid vegan, you know, 80% raw food and all that stuff. But as a type O, the only way I could do that was by doing 2 protein shakes a day and swallowing handfuls of supplements. So I tried doing it without the protein shakes. I did like 1 protein shake, and then I did a handful of amino acids. So these are free-form crystalline amino acids. Should have been absorbed immediately and given me everything that I need as a meat eater, and yet it was not enough. And I was literally
starving.
That's
because of blood types, you mean? You're suggesting
yeah.
that's because of the way you metabolize differently
right.
than, let's say, an A, B.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I started noticing these differences and going, huh, you know, theoretically, if you're taking a handful of amino acids and they're all of the amino acids that you need that you would be eating meat to get, and yet it's not enough and you're literally starving, then there's something else at work there. So I think there's something beyond just the amino acids. There are
right.
different chemicals, you know, that contained in meat. And I think that what they do is they fire different parts of the brain, and it's not strictly a protein question. It's also a question of these other chemicals.
Right. I agree with that. I'm not a nutritionist. My academic backgrounds are in solid-state physics, but that's what I have observed even in my own self, and that there are certain kinds of foods that I can't eat a lot of, like chocolate. Chocolate cures everything, but if I were to eat a lot of chocolate, like I might, I break out in hives and zits. It's really interesting. My body can't handle too much of certain kinds of chemistries like theobromine or ethylamine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing, too, is like when you're talking about chocolate, it's the delivery system that could be the problem. For instance, brownies are one delivery system, and a straight chocolate bar with nothing added to it is another. So if you're having problems when you're eating the baked goods like brownies, it's because you're actually reacting to the wheat and the sugar. Whereas if you're eating something that's, you know, 80%, you know, raw cacao with a little bit of honey or something, it's going to be metabolized totally differently, and it's not going to act as an allergen in your body, whereas the brownie will. So it all depends on, you know, how you're ingesting this stuff. And for instance, if you take milk chocolate, that's not healthy. But
you know, I'd like to say something further about delivery systems.
Mm-hmm.
There are some new delivery systems that are being explored in the pharmaceutical trade that are kind of interesting. The first and most interesting one is called nanotechnology, where they take a product like our mushrooms and run it through a jet engine at Mach 3, and it shreds it down to, let's say, 400 nanometers.
Mm-hmm.
Normal capsulation is 80 mesh, and that means there's 80 particles per inch, and that is enough to sift through and go into a capsule that then is digested in the gut. It's already been shown that the amount of absorption of the gut is only about 38%. However, if you have it at 400 nanometers, that means that the product is at least 100 times smaller than the cell wall and will fall through the cell wall just by gravity. And so what, let's say you had a, you needed to get some kind of food to your lung. If it was at 400 nanometers, all you have to do is lay on your back and sprinkle the product on your chest, and it will literally fall to the lung and be absorbed completely, 100% absorption. That's one of the reasons why some of our products are now put at 400 nanometers, because you need only one-third the amount to have the same clinical effect, and yet, you know, like, take so many grams or whatever to get to a certain level of ATP levels in your body, at nanometer, it would be one-third that. In other words, if you were at 525 milligrams, and maybe 150 milligrams is good enough for 200 milligrams, and you're getting a more powerful punch for the for less product being absorbed. I would have said that's probably why the alien studies that I've never participated in that show they don't have any digestive system is because probably they don't need a gut. They probably absorb, as we will at some point in our evolution, have foods that are absorbed directly into, like if you wanted to get something into the brain without having to go through the blood-brain barrier, you sprinkle it on the top of your head if you're going to do some walking. And just fall right directly into the brain.
That reminds
me. That's New Denton technology.
Very, very interesting. And that reminds me of what we were talking about the other night about the popes wearing mushroom caps on their
heads. You mean the Amanita muscaria and the Pope's Cradle? Yeah. In the 16th century, the Pope in the Vatican, those actual pictures, you know, artwork, showing where they took the Amanita muscaria, put it up into a mash, you know, a boiled mash, and then the Pope would sprinkle it on and smear it on the top of his head, shaved, so that he could get closer to God. That's Clark Heinrich's book, you know, Magical Mushrooms, Sacred Mushrooms. Yeah, there are some really interesting people out there that have been doing things for a long time with psychoactive elements.
Yeah, and that's one thing, just for the listeners, would you give them a brief rundown of your background with the studies that you did with Navy? Because
basically, when I came out of, Navy had me pegged in high school, and, of course they orchestrated my undergraduate work, and then my work with DuPont, and then when I came out of graduate school from Princeton and MIT, I worked for SEAL Corporation, which was before we were called Navy SEALs, and I did all their, spook central stuff. I was in anesthesiology, so we did all the mind control. We did drug studies with ketamine and telepathy, and we did chip implants. There was a guy in the lab next to me called Delgado that had monkeys with chips in their head, and then Moore was doing ketamine and telepathy, and you don't even want to know what I was doing. And I did so well that they moved me up into Spook Central, where I became right under Dr. Carl Schleicher. I was Northwest Regional Director and ran most of the West Coast, including China Lake, Argonne, Livermore. We had, at Boeing Scientific Research Labs, we had different places where we had maybe 100 studies ongoing at any given moment. This was in, like, 76, 77. And my website has a paper that my ex-wife wrote called I Married the Wizard of Oz, where she runs down some of the studies she saw me doing when she came into my life. I was already half through most of that and was now thinking about how do I get out of this weird place and go become a dirt farmer, which is what I've been doing for the last 35 years, is farming. And now, because of what's probably going to happen with pole shifts and things like that, I couldn't have chosen a better direction of physics, and I'm sure that's why Navy allowed me to just do what I did, go into agriculture. That's what I've been doing for the last 35 years, doing things like these pharmaceutical mushrooms, making discoveries on foods and things like that. I was always more interested in inside the head rather than outside. My physics took me into altered states of consciousness studies. That's what we did mostly. ESP, and microwave, that kind of thing. We did a lot of that, those kinds of studies. I'm a physicist, you know, that was went into solid-state physics. General Corso has a new book out called The Day After Roswell. He's got a whole chapter in there on me called Mad Max. That was my code name, Max. I was up in Seattle, and I was this whiz kid that was doing weird shit in anesthesiology up there. It was fun. We had fun, but basically I couldn't believe what I was doing, and that's when I became a dirt farmer. Moved into the country, started learning how to grow herbs.
Well, and I think that's probably karmically really a good choice.
Well, I feel like it now in light of, you know, I'm going to be flying back in the Midwest in 2 weeks to work for Dennis Kucinich. They want me to start some small farm movements with networking, you know, these little bunker places that they have all throughout North America. There's all hidey-downs, you know, lots of religious groups, government, non-government, have stockpiles like the Latter-day Saints, the Assembly of God, some of the other places. They have these communities with bunkers. And, of course, Grants Pass is a haven for that. I mean, you can go on to Google Earth and enjoy looking around on the different mountains. It'll blow your mind. All the different bunkers in there. Not gold mines, trust me. And basically, it's going to be about how to survive growing your own foods. That's where it's going to start. It's going to be so important for people to know how to grow things for themselves. How to grow corn, you know, how to milk a cow, those kinds of things. These are skills and knowledge that is being lost left and right as various states go from being agricultural communities into tourism. It isn't going to last long. And it's not going to be about money or gold. It's going to be about how healthy you are and what skills you bring to the table.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can tell you that as I've traveled across the country this last year, I have had at least three groups ask me to be a part of their group. And I keep telling them.
I wish I had invitations like that. Mostly people just tell me to, never mind. Well, I don't get those kinds of invitations, but they want my information. They want, you know, like Bill Gates is doing a huge seed repository up in Iceland. Why do you think he's doing that? Why do you think that Seeds of Change here in Oregon has the heirloom studies that they're doing and things like that? This is essential, essential for the survival
Absolutely.
Of man. Yeah.
And, you know, and people are getting prepared. And, you know, I've seen it, and Madeline has seen it. And, I mean, you know, we are watching as people are very quietly hunkering down.
Because you mean trying to learn how to take care of themselves?
Yeah.
We're way too dependent on our food sources and things like that. And food's coming in from Peru and China is wrong. It's wrong. It's metaphysically wrong. It's economically wrong. It's wrong, wrong, wrong. It basically, we should have barter and trade where I'll grow some Indian herbal coffee and I'll swap you for your corn. How's that sound?
Mm-hmm.
That kind
well,
of thing.
It's definitely gotten interesting with all the contaminants in the food from China.
Well, that's the deal. That's the real deal. And just to let you have a broader perspective, I like to use this little metaphor. You know, there's lots of things you can grow. How about gallium and arsenic as gallium arsenide crystals to make solar panels? You can mine arsenic out of serpentine soils like we have around here. Gallium is everywhere. And you can grow these crystals and cleave them and make solar panels, which I might add is no moving parts. That means there's no wood consciousness to it. It's, and the, you know, solar panels burn out. They have color centers, and you have to replace them and so on. But you can grow that like a crop.
Mm.
It's like metaphor. What's that?
Yeah, that's a very fascinating statement.
Yeah, it's all in metaphor. The whole thing is, it's the same thing. It's your relationship to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. very interesting. And you know, you and I have had a lot of conversations.
Yeah,
about
I know.
The fact
I love you too.
Are going.
Well, the thing is that reality, you know, I have, when I was working for Navy, one of the things they had me do is they went in, they wanted to know if these Hopi medicine men that were claiming to change weather, if they could really change weather or not. And mostly what I do is go in and bust people. But I went in, and I'm watching these two old men mumbling to themselves, and while they're doing that, they're making this little sand painting, and it's a beautiful sand painting. I mean, it's really kind of cool. It's got design to it like a mandala, and they're making this little sand painting, and as they're doing it, I'm noticing that the weather is kind of like some science fiction movie. It's like changing out of nothing. How does that work? And the one medicine man, he looked down at the sand painting, then looked up at me, looked back at the sand painting, looked back at me, and he winked at me, and he ran his hand right through the sand painting and ruined it, and the weather went back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I paused, and I sat there in disbelief, and then I stepped back, and I looked at the sand painting, and you know, it looked like a solid-state physics device. Technology has many faces, and it's really not about our explanation of how something works. It's the mind's eye. A woman, when she puts the key into an ignition, is not thinking about how an internal engine combustion works. She's going through a little ritual, and the ritual has expectations of reality out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if it doesn't work, she calls the local medicine man at the garage. He comes down, does a little hocus pocus, and the next, you know, it's working right again. Ritual. But it's not about internal engine combustion. It's about her mind's eye of what she believes should happen next. And that is the whole essence of the non-local mind.
And you just described perfectly the way that I start a car, and I take them to finish. Whenever I have to go in and take the car in for something, if it's not working, the first thing I say is, you know, and they're questioning me, well, what happened? What sound did it make? And all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the first thing I say is, look, here's what I know. You put the key in, and you turn it, and it's supposed to go. And, now, I do know a little
really
bit more about cars
than that.
That's
really helpful to them, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, you know,
That's totally it. That's the way I think about the car. I put the key in, I turn it, it goes.
There's another way to do it. You may not even need a car.
Yeah, well, I've had that experience, too.
Well, you know, astral projection, there you go, or even soul travel. There's lots of ways to move around. The automobile is probably not going to happen much longer. You know, when I go to visit someone, I always left something more than I received. I always wanted to be welcomed back. I always wanted to. And it's a metaphor for small farm, rural community values where in the book Ecotopia by Ernest Callenbach, which was my generation's Ecotopia book, it was called Ecotopia, and it's about Washington, Oregon, and California seceding from the Union in the 80s, and then they open it up in the year 2000, you know, 20 years later, where there's no vehicles, it's run by a woman president, and, you know, it's how these three states lived as isolated rural communities. The way they kept the United States out, as they said, all that missing plutonium is stockpiled in major cities, leave us alone. And that's how the book starts off. And then basically what happens next is they show that there's community bicycles like you do in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. Everybody in Amsterdam rides a bicycle. Everybody. At any age, rain or shine. And it's like they don't belong to you. You leave a bicycle, you pick up a different one. It's a community bicycle. And obviously you can put a lock on your bicycle if you want to keep your bicycle, but they don't even think about it like that. It's like more like community transportation. And there's a whole raft of bicycles. You just grab one to go somewhere. That's Amsterdam. And a lot of Europe does that kind of thing. As gasoline gets higher, I think we're going to need more singular, smaller vehicles like Segways, these little electric cars, you know, that run off the solar winds, whatever. It isn't going to be yellow fuel from corn. In the state of Oregon, we had a law that it's no longer in, but at one time we had a law that made it illegal for you to grow corn in the same ground 2 years in a row. You had to rotate that because corn was so hard on the soil. Why the government would be talking about corn as an alternative substitute is craziness. It's like, if you're going to use biomass, the highest biomass yield would be comfrey. And it's got a taproot that goes down 18 feet. It doesn't mess up with the topsoil at all. And you get, you know, 10 ton to an acre in cuttings, something like that, in biomass. So that's your sin fuel. But hogs and fart power like they used in Thunderdome, that's a reality. There are all kinds of things we could be doing besides now Toshiba has invented a nuclear reactor battery for a home. You buy it, it's enough to heat your home for 40 years, and then you discard the battery or whatever it is, like a little, it's a fusion, it's a nuclear reactor that you can carry around in a suitcase that would heat a home. And that's the newest off-the-shelf inventions from Toshiba. And I'm thinking of all the radioactive material required and the rods and all that kind of shit. It won't blow up. They've built them. They've designed them so they're stable. They're like little batteries. But that's the problem with our refuge piles now, our batteries. You know, the cadmium sulfate, all the, some of these weird chemistries they use in EverReady and, you know, the keeps on going battery. You know,
yeah.
It's like, yeah. Those things are so toxic to the earth, like plastic is, that I think you're going to see a huge rejection. Now, who makes all the plastic and gunpowder in the world? That's DuPont. I mean, there's one of your nine families, and Rockefeller's right in there with a bunch of others. The whole thing in agriculture got sidetracked with petrochemicals, where they wanted large farms using large petro, you know, from fossil fuel chemistry to keep weed control or to sterilize the ground or do whatever they did. And the whole thing was based around oil. And that's the first thing that's got to go. We've got to get rid of our, you know, oil might be as important to someone's life as God, the way we all live. If you know what you pay your attention to, is what you're about, and what do we pay attention to in terms of transportation and freedom of moving here to there. And I think airlines, I think you're going to see everything changing now, massively changing.
That'll be really interesting.
Well, yes and no. What it's really about is that there's too many people on Earth, and that before there can be any advancements in medicine, before there can be any evolution of consciousness, before there can be any return of our civil rights, there's going to need to be a reduction of maybe 50% of the Earth, right, literally, overnight. Now, that's your pulse shift or your 2012, your Mayan calendar, whatever. You know, Joseph Campbell said it best when he said, when you see the kingdom of the Father on Earth, the apocalypse has already occurred, that it is perpetual in its potential. It's like ever-present. And so 2012, well, that'll be Planet X. There's a planetoid, a small moon, moving through our solar system right now. It's just past Neptune and coming near Jupiter right now. And in the year 2012, we'll pass closest to Mars, between Earth and Mars. But the mass on it is so intense that it heated the core of Jupiter as it did Neptune when it went by them. And so there's a high likelihood that it's going to do the same thing to Earth and Mars. And what happens next is the poles are going to shift because of all the ice. And whether it's a catastrophic or it's another ice age, you know, like man has survived many times before, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen there. I know that it will be a pole shift. I know that it will be in the next few years. And that's why it's important to learn now how to farm and garden and produce at least some of your food. Learn how to do that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are a lot of people running around saying stockpile your food, but they don't realize you still have to have some fresh food.
Well, it isn't about stockpiling. That's only going to last for 2 years while the metal's up in the atmosphere and blocking light and killing all your wheat. But after that, which will be probably a couple years, now we're going to need to replant. And trees, forests, and we're going to need to know how to farm them because, you know, a forest is not a tree plantation. A plantation is not a forest. A forest is different with mycorrhizia and the habitat of the uniqueness of the soil. You know, the soil is conscious. It actually, there's studies right now at the University of Oregon that are showing that mycorrhizia may, in fact, be a quantum computation algorithm or a supercomputer like Gaia. Conscious.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And then the next question is, what happens when the mantle heats up?
Well, that's according to Bayer, B-A-E-R. He's a science fiction writer, science physicist. He wrote three books called Epoch. I forget what the other two are, but they're about that very thing happening when the poles shift and it's catastrophic. What happens next is a bunch of aliens show up and they take 144,000 of them up into space to witness it and the death of Mother before they relocate them to Mars. That's science fiction. But what I wanted to say is, from a metaphor point of view, it will be like that. There is the possibility of the pole shift this time being catastrophic. That is, Bert Bolin at University of Stockholm, he's basically, astrophysicist, Nobel Prize winner, is saying it's going to be catastrophic. I don't know. I think man is a pretty hardy mammal, and I know that there are several mammals on this earth that are more evolved technically than man, and like the orca and the dolphin and the pilot whale and the manatee, they have bigger brain cases, and they've demonstrated technologies we don't have. You know, the dolphin have a thing called sonoluminescence where they blow these little bubbles out of their mouth into forms and shapes that just before they hit the surface of the water, they pop open with bright light, which is a type of cold fusion we're now producing at MIT, and it's called sonoluminescence, and that's the dolphin's art form, and they're lower on the food chain than orca. What do you think? Orca's got a cerebral cortex that's twice the size of man, and they're firing 60% of it, where man's lucky to even have 8 to 10%. That's like God. Not our God, necessarily, but certainly a type of God going places and grokking things we could possibly never, even as we are manufactured the way we are, could never achieve that level of scholarship. It's interesting.
It's very interesting. And having swam with the whales and the dolphins, I mean, I can tell you that they are supremely...
Something else there, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they know exactly why we're there. They will sonar you and heal you. And, I mean, they get their point across, you know, quite succinctly.
Well, I went to Dolphins Plus, the rehab center in Key Largo, and got to spend most of the day in with six dolphins working with them. And I have to tell you, I felt like I was in the presence of a more evolved entity than myself, and I consider myself pretty aware and pretty smart, but these dolphins, there's something else. There's something else there. You can't put your finger on it. There was a thing on that History Channel, I think, or Animal Channel, where they showed a bunch of dolphins that saved a group of swimmers from the great white up in the Barrier Reefs, where they kept the great white away until the, and it was like hours that they did that to protect the humans before they got them to shore. The dolphin did that as like with intentionality and purpose. You know, there's awareness going on there. Meanwhile, the Japanese are fishing them like they would Charlie Tuna. Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, it's just in belief systems and the way people, values that people have. That's what it's really all about. Values and belief systems.
Yeah, and so I'm all for getting people into into better belief systems, you know, knocking them out of the old ones that are getting
involved. Well, yeah, that's what I'm writing about. That's what my books are about, is how to change belief systems like you would a pair of clothing. Like, sometimes a given belief system, you don't have to give it up. I mean, you know, a belief system could be something you cherish, but it not be appropriate in a given situation. I have a pair of bell bottoms I'm never going to fit in again, ever. But
some clothes
you think
like
I'd ever throw those pair of bell bottoms away? You damn not. That's like a belief system. There's certain ones that I can't wear. They're not appropriate, whatever. But, you know, it doesn't mean I get rid of them.
Well, you know, the 60s die hard.
Yeah, I know. Very, very hard. And it's not for the timid. Getting old.
Yeah, yeah. I keep telling everybody that, you know, getting older is not for wimps.
Yeah, that's right. It's not. It's a scary place. And I'm loving it. I'm 64. I took early retirement. They actually sent thugs out to interview me because they didn't believe I was not making the money. I had corporations, see. I had the whole thing set up, so it's my money. I want it. And it's not even going to be there in a couple of years, I figure. So I'm trying to take advantage of it right now and dig in. You know, learning how to go back to the simple things in life, how to farm, how to walk, how to ride a bicycle, something that you can fix and make that doesn't require petroleum or fuels. Yeah.
Well, now that's something. You have to grow some bicycle tires or something.
Tires, rubber.
We have
analogs here in the Pacific Northwest that would work besides rubber. You know, there's other kinds of things that can be made. You can jelly certain kinds of kelp and make them into rubber-like. But
yeah,
they biodegrade.
Very interesting.
Where rubber will sit there and smoke for a zillion years. Oh. The only thing I've ever found good for old tires is to use them to grow tomatoes. You use three tires on top of each other. It keeps the heat of the soil and the water down in there, and then the vines climb over the tires. That's the only thing I ever found good for old used tires.
I don't think I'd want to grow my tomatoes like that, though, because I'd be concerned about the, you know, as the tires decay, that the plants would take
out. No, basically what a tire does is act like a big heat sink and keeps the soil warmer than even the sun, which means your tomato plants grow better, and it holds the moisture in the soil. You don't have any leaching of rubber into the soil, although, you know, you can be a purist if you want to. I'm just practical, you know, and I'm saying I'm like a physicist, and I'm not so much worried about the rubber tires. I might, what Bendix Corporation might have buried there 100 years ago is a pit.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's going on the East Coast. Yeah. The whole place is toxic. Everywhere you live now, there's stuff getting into the groundwater and whatever because of old dump sites. It's terrible.
Yeah,
Connecticut, Vermont.
So
what?
Some that are not so old, too.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, we had a big problem in the Phoenix Valley from Motorola, where they had, with all their components they were making, they actually had TCE that went into the water supply.
Yeah.
They closed
causes leukemia,
well.
For criminy's sake. You know, I mean, this stuff is, it's not good. And you need to learn how to make soil, you know, because like I live in the city and the lawn I have is dead. It's got mosses in it, you know, and who knows whatever, weeds, there's no grass left. I mean, it's all weird shit. And so what I'm doing is I'm making compost piles where I bring in some horse and steer manure and some dirt, and I add it to my compost, and I try to make soil so that at least when I leave this place, at least I left the soil more alive than it was when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Boy, yeah, that's a social responsibility issue.
Well, it's, you know, levels of awareness, too, though.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole thing, and that's the purpose of shows and talks like this, is for me to get people to start thinking about these things because they're going to have to start doing that soon. And so it's time to start thinking about a victory garden and why you want to grow it this way over it that way. There's lots of ways to do it, French intensive, whatever, certified organic. But you need to start thinking about that kind of thing.
Oh, we have a caller. Okay, who do we have calling in? Hello, caller? Hello?
Oh, yes, are you speaking to me?
Yes, I am.
We are now, okay. Yes, hi.
Yeah, no, actually, I'm waiting for the next show. I'm the guest with Dr. Horowitz, I believe.
Okay.
Oh, okay, well, that's fine. Valerie, it's
yes.
been a pleasure, I guess.
Yes, it has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for being on the show, Rick. And why don't you go ahead and give your...
websites? I have a bunch
yeah.
of websites.
Yeah, go ahead and give those out.
Yeah, if you're interested to know more about what I'm doing, and I have a lot of downloads, and I have a lot of technical information available on the mushrooms, on these new delivery systems, on work I did with Navy SEALs, that kind of thing. My primary website is richardallenmiller.com. And Allen is A-L-A-N, so it's richardallenmiller.com or nwbotanicals.org. That's for Northwest Botanicals, plural, the creature under the bridge. That's nwbotanicals.org. And then I have a couple of new sites. One is called dogcancer.ca for Canada. And another one is alohamedicinals.ca. out of Canada. We represent Aloha Medicinals and the large pharmaceutical productions of these pharmaceutical mushrooms in Carson City, Nevada. We're doing a couple hundred thousand pounds a month of mushrooms, cultivating them, and certified organic. And then if people are interested, they can always get toward me via my email or through you, Dr. Val.
That's right, because Rick is my good buddy.
And yes, you're my good friend, too. It's so a pleasure to have you visiting with me right now.
Oh,
I really
so much...
have enjoyed your visit.
Oh, thank you. And I really have enjoyed it also. And so here we are out in the cold northwest in the rain. We went through the...
Oh, yeah, poured down rain at the beaches today.
Yeah, went to the beaches
yeah.
and have just been talking up a storm about quantum physics and about mushrooms and about social issues and all that kind of stuff. So
anytime
you
need me, Val. Yeah, anytime you'd like me to talk more, I'd be happy to.
You betcha.
You know, if they go to Holographic Paradigm and Wikipedia, they'll find out who I really am. We were the originators of the holographic concept of reality almost 10 years before Carl Pribram or John Bohm. All of my stuff was classified top secret. Here I am 47 years later still writing on the same stuff. The non-local mind in a holographic universe. How you make things go from psyche into matter, making it physical.
That's an important thing. With that, we're going to go ahead and end. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thank you so much, Rick, for being on the show. It's always a pleasure. And listeners, as always, be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty-night.